Morning, everyone. Awake and ready? Great. Please join me in prayer. Oh, Heavenly Father. Divine Mother. Beloved Jesus Christ. Blessed Master.
Dearest Mother.
Saints and sages of all religions.
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart my home, thy home.
Make my heart thy home.
May thou be the beloved.
Ever enshrined.
In my temple within. Some chants, please. Such a lovely time celebrating Mother's Mahasamadhi last week. And in our graveside ceremony, I read a poem from Rebecca Barnau that I think is just beautiful and very insightful. I've made copies and they're on the table back there. Rebecca gave permission to use it as I see fit. So you have to be careful, you know, when you give permission like that. You never know what's going to happen. It's entitled, How Can I Ever Say Goodbye? To my dearest mother, I have never stopped to look upon your grave, though the seasons year by year have rippled past, adorned with splendor, and the vibrancy of youth now melds into a nuanced tapestry woven by sapience. Still, I feel your hand enfolding mine, in tenderest repose conveying without sound such peace-filled eruditions that even tears can find no place. How can I ever say goodbye? You are the whispering infinitude, closer than breathing. And though the shafts of sorrow here have rent many to their depth, and raw winds have bent even the aspirations of the heroic low, winnowing each where he stands to the merest strand of selfhood, still I know the power of your illumined love, broadcasting across the arc of perfect being, infilling the vacant, careworn hearts that broke asunder from too much longing, dreaming you are mortal after all, and that they were all alone. Such pain may have been anticipated by those who came before. Sri Yukteswar himself spoke straight to the heart. Remember that finding God will mean the funeral of all sorrows, something to contemplate. And though the decades pass like hours under the sunlit, star-lit vault of wisdom's widening gaze, I hear your voice resounding still, its timeless cadence ringing through the forest lands of reverie, the scent of lilac lingering. You are perennial joy, calling your children scattered everywhere, over mountains and across continents and seas, calling your children of every color and race, into the dew-kissed apertures of endlessness, where there is no ceiling or limitation or ending, in the peerless sanctuary of purest love. In celebration of Yogacharya Mother Hamilton's 19th Mahasamadhi, January 31st, 2010. And Notes from Anandashram by our Larry G., who's now back in Nagpur after spending a week or so at Anandashram. And he writes, I had two easy airplane jumps from Mangalore to Bombay to Nagpur. Pretty comfortable in the airports these days. Mangalore Airport is very nice now. It has really been spruced up and modernized. There's a new international airport going in near the domestic airport. Soon we can fly directly to Mangalore and skip the Bombay to Mangalore flight. Won't that be nice? And also to support that there is a new concrete highway, about 60% finished, going up to the new airport. I heard someone say that the airport will start operating in a month. Swami Muktananda loaded me up with prasad last night. I have some of Swamiji's ashes to give to you, David and Carla. Swami Muktananda was a little reticent. He said that they, meaning he and Swami Satchidananda, didn't like to encourage this, but he relented after I asked him three times. I had asked Larry and Swami Muktananda. I don't also go in for that all that much, but for some reason I felt it important for us to have his ashes here. As he gave me the packets with the precious ash, he looked over at Swamiji's picture and said to him, I'm giving it to him, Swamiji, and then laughed and said that he couldn't refuse me. He seriously seemed to apologize to Swamiji, but his laughter told me the whole story because he seemed to be having Swamiji's blessing, and as I looked up at to Swamiji's picture, his eyes seemed to sparkle. At least, that is my interpretation of the little side discussion he had with Swamiji. I woke up this morning, packed and got ready, and then walked around the ashram for quite a while this morning. I talked to many of the inmates and guests. Swami Muktananda walked out of the Ramana building and invited me along for his trip to the Centenary Hall, which I had already spent time in this morning, and then off to the flower ceremony. Along the way, I asked him about Swamiji's passing, if he was there for all of it, and what it was like. It was very moving. Swamiji stopped in mid-stride and began a short account of Swamiji's passing. Tears welled up in his eyes as soon as he stopped and started to think about that special day. He choked up and had to stop talking for a few seconds before he recommenced. Though duties were calling him to the Centenary Hall and to the Bhajan Hall, once he started he had to tell the whole thing, and we were both very uplifted in spirit as he held me spellbound. Larry speaking, were you with Swamiji when he passed? Swami Muktananda, oh yes, about 3 p.m. I was with him and his blood pressure was very low and his pulse was nearly stopped. Swamiji was awake and looking at me so intently. I asked him if he would like some tirtha water and he nodded with his eyes. I called out and asked for tirtha water, that's blessed water, to be brought to Swamiji. When it came, we gave him just a few drops. He was intently looking at me, and then his pulse stopped, but he continued looking at me. He couldn't talk. Slowly, slowly, we noticed that his pulse started up and his blood pressure came almost to normal. A little later, his blood pressure and pulse lowered, and he slipped into a coma for over 4 hours. Then at 8:10, his heart stopped, and he was gone. Swami Muktananda, tears glistening in his very intent eyes. He was in such great pain those last few hours. Also, that last week, he was in such pain. Really, from early September on, he was in great pain. Such pain, ah. It is hard to watch this go on, you see. He couldn't talk to us those last weeks. He couldn't talk, but no one could understand him. He would talk, but nobody could understand him. Such a difficult last chapter to his life. The last trip to Mangalore for dialysis, oh, it was hard on him. Swami Muktananda, almost unable to continue. When he got there, his blood pressure was so low that we didn't dare do the procedure. So we came back, and that ride in the car was very difficult for him. We could do nothing more. Swami Muktananda's eyes looking into the distance. He was done. His work was done. Larry, he went through all of this for all of us. Swami Muktananda, Acha, meaning yes. Then we proceeded to the centenary hall, and in the back bedrooms, the scene of this crucifixion and Swamiji, pronouns to Swamiji's picture on the bed there. He stared for over 2 minutes while we all sat with our hands folded in prayer, watching him. The room was so very still. Such love Swami Muktananda has for our beloved Swami Satchidananda. He was and is the center of his life. The only measure of his own worth is in this perfect master's good opinion of him. Afterwards, we walked out together, and he blessed me as I went to catch my taxi, and he hurried on to the beginning of a new day in the ashram, the flower ceremony. Sighed Larry. And from Papa, do all sadhanas in a spirit of joy. Let cheerfulness be their keynote. With delight in the heart and a light of step, go to meet the beloved mother who is always yours. You are her acknowledged child. Reading from Master's Commentary on the Gita. This is chapter 6, verse 46. The yogi is deemed greater than the body-disciplining ascetics, greater than even the followers of the path of wisdom or the path of action. Be thou, O Arjuna, a yogi. Master's Commentary. Asceticism is a bypath because it teaches man to reach God indirectly by outer renunciation and physical discipline. The path of theoretical wisdom is also a bypath, because it teaches the confusing way of academically reasoning about him. The path of action is also a bypath, because it teaches the circuitous way of reaching God through external good actions. I remember when I was going to the University of Washington, and I thought for a time that I might specialize in philosophy and take my emphasis in that area. But after spending a few classes in the philosophy department there, I discovered that people were much more interested about arguing about truth than they were discovering the truth. And so I really found that there was a differentiation. Those who try to approach truth or God through reason and through the reasoning faculty, and how much ego there was within the professorial staff and others there in trying to outdo one another. And it didn't seem like that there was, in my experience there may be for others, but not for mine, there wasn't any truly sincere seekers there. The one exception to that was a guest speaker they had. It was a grandson of Mohandas Gandhi. And he was wonderful. And Larry arranged it so that he could come and see Mother, and they had a wonderful time together. And here was a true searcher for God, for truth, for the ultimate reality. But the others I can't say so much for. So those paths are the indirect ways. Master continuing here, the Lord himself here extols the royal path of yoga as the highest of all spiritual paths, and the scientific yogi as greater than the follower of any other path. The real Kriya Yogi way is life force control, is not a bypath. It is the direct highway, the shortest route to divine realization. It teaches man to ascend heavenward by leading the ego, mind, and life force through the spinal channel that was used when the soul originally descended into the body. And you can see here how direct this path is. When we start dealing directly with the spine and the brain and the life energy and force that flows down through the spine and brain that informs this body of how to function, how to operate in this world, it is what every single one of us uses in order to get by in this world. And depending on how we use this life force energy, we either benefit ourselves or we detract from our lives and create habits, create patterns that can be very difficult to break. But by reversing that life force and bringing up through the spine and the brain, something wonderful can happen. The spirit as soul has descended through the subtle astral cerebral spinal centers into the brain and the spinal plexus and into the nervous system, the senses and the rest of the body, and becomes entangled there as the pseudo-soul or ego. In the body-identified state, the ego engages in further involvements in and with the objective world. The ego has to be made to ascend through the same spinal path until it realizes its true self as the soul, and the soul reunites with spirit. It's a very interesting thing if you were to observe from spiritual insight the baby as it comes into this world and slowly acclimates itself to this world. In the beginning, the eyes are not very clear. It sees this world as a homogeneous type of creation, all of an extension of its own self. And what it is mostly interested in is rooted in the first chakra, and that is survival. It needs to have food, it needs to have warmth, it needs to have comfort in order to survive. There have been experiments that some might call these sadistic psychologists do on these poor little rats. But they'll take rats and they'll put them into an extremely overcrowded condition. And naturally, so they don't do very well. They fight with each other. They claw at each other. They have a difficult time of it. Then they have some that are in the ideal conditions and they do much better, of course. Then they'll take one poor little rat and they'll put him off all by himself. And what do you think the result is? That rat dies. He's got food. He's got water. He's got plenty of space, but he's got no one else around him. No touch, no relationship, and that one will be weak, it will be sick, and it will die much sooner than the other rats. So that's a very interesting thing. So that kind of survival is absolutely essential for a baby, and as human beings, we're born into this world without any means to survive on our own. None. And we need absolute support, and we're one of the animals in this animal kingdom that needs the longest amount of nurturing time in order to get us prepared to enter into our adult state of being. So this is the first stage. And then we grow to have likes and dislikes. We grow to learn about the senses. And we like it when our mother is near, and we like it when she's far. We don't like it when she's far. We like the sense of touch, and you'll see children, they'll start to put everything into their mouth. They know the world through taste. And they'll smell things, and they'll touch things. And they're learning to acclimate themselves to the five senses. And so the sense of pleasure that comes, and knowledge of pleasure through the second center comes into being. And then they enter into what's known as the infamous twos. And that's when that child will turn around and for the very first time wind up everything that's inside of them and turn to their mother and say no when they ask them to do something. And they're learning to exercise will. And you can see them make calculations in their mind as there becomes a power struggle between the parent and the child. And if the parent says no and the child wants to, you can watch the machinery of the mind of that child go to work and calculating, is it worth it? Do I dare go against what my parent says? And sometimes they will and sometimes they won't. So this is the third chakra, the place of will. And so you can see this development happen as the soul becomes acclimated to that body, to the social circumstances, to the language, to everything that goes on around them. And as they do so, most often they forget who they are, they forget where they come from. A child in the beginning sleeps for long hours, maybe 20 hours a day it sleeps. It's still residing mostly in the astral heavens. And it then comes and it's a little bit time here on earth, and then it goes and escapes back into its astral heaven again until it finally begins to acclimate itself to this world. And gradually gets oriented. And then the astral worlds are relegated to the dreams and to dreamland. I don't know about you, but when I was a child in particular, I had a wonderful flying dream. And in that flying dream, I would go to the concrete retaining wall that was between our house and the neighbor's house. It was just 2.5-3 feet high. And I would climb up on top of that, and then I would jump off. And as I jumped very high, I would float down like a feather then. And I could turn somersaults, and I could float all the way down to the ground. And then I'd run, and I'd get on there again, and I'd do it again. And it was great fun. And so the soul, many times, experiences its relief and release from the physical confines within the astral realms. And so gradually, this astral realms gets relegated to the place of myth, gets relegated to the place where that's just what some stories say about heaven, afterlife, before life, and so on. And we lose all confidence in it because it's not necessary to us in the moment. If we can cultivate in our children that sense of wonderment, if we don't deny to them the experiences that they have. We have one little one in the group who will walk up to his cousin and put his hand on his stomach. He'll do a diagnosis. And amazingly enough, his diagnosis is often right as to what might be physically wrong. And so these kinds of natural intuitive faculties are there. And if we can encourage them and help them to refine them and attune them rather than to deny them. We learn in our families what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. I remember as a child I used to listen to the Om. I called it the sound of silence. I had no real word for it or understanding of it, but it would get so deafening that it would hurt my head. And I'd be sitting in the silence of my room and I'd be listening to this tremendous sound. But I never mentioned it to a soul, you know, because in Sunday school and other places, I never heard about such things. I was having a little mini Sunday school with two of our precious little ones, and in the range of 5 and 9 years old. And we were talking about looking for the spiritual light at the ajna. And one says, whenever I look at the ajna, I always see blue. And the other one says, I always see gold. Now, isn't that a marvelous thing? And if they can maintain that, if they can keep that, what a difference that will make in their lives. They'll keep that connection with that inner light. And to have that inner light continue as a constant feature, that they could listen to the Om and they would understand it, that they learn to listen to their hearts and rise up above the tumultuous worlds of the lowest chakras. You see, these are the things that happen naturally in more enlightened ages. But we live in an age now where everything is about this world, everything is about the body, there is violence, there is all sorts of difficulties. And sometimes, you know, I feel like I'm Rachel in the Old Testament crying for the lost children of Israel, the ones who are killed, because my heart just bleeds for the conditions of this world, for the souls that are lost, for the violence that is done, for the hunger that goes on, and for the lack of physical needs that are fulfilled. It's really a tough place. Now, we're getting better. We're getting better. It's not as bad as it was a few hundred years ago, or even 100 years ago. And so we're gradually improving, but it's a very much one step forward and sometimes 2 steps back. But we are moving toward the light. the more we can cultivate this in all souls. And these truths will one day be as natural and common sense as anything that we've ever believed about this world. You know, you can relate back to the time when they thought this world was flat and everybody just agreed upon it, because that was the common thought at the time. And those who said it was curved or round were ridiculed and laughed out of town. Now it would be just the opposite. It seems a self-evident fact. And so these great spiritual truths, as they come forward, will eventually be just commonplace. Though people will think, of course, that's exactly how it is. I could never imagine it any other way. And so these truths that Master brought to the Western world, that at the time were revolutionary, even within our group here, everybody would think, by and large, that these are self-evident facts. And many, 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 most have had experiences that have revealed to them the truth of these things that are being spoken of here. Yoga points out that this spinal route is the one straight highway that is all earth-descended mortal beings must follow in the final ascension to liberation. All other paths, those that emphasize the performance of tapasya, bodily and mental discipline, self-discipline, or theoretical knowledge of the scriptures, the gaining of wisdom by discrimination, or the performance of all good actions, are auxiliary paths that somewhere join the highway of practical yoga that leads straight to liberation. Now, I've said many times that I consider what we follow as the fourfold path, because really you can't separate out these different paths. It's just merely a thing of emphasis. And for some, they have difficulty with meditation. They have difficulty turning the mind within, but they have good and pure hearts. And so they go out and serve, and they work at meditation, and they do the best that they can. But that's not playing to their strength. And so they emphasize more the path of good actions. And they do it through their work, through their family, through other voluntary means that they seek to serve this world. There are others who are naturally more of an intellectual inclination. And so they read more about the scriptures, they study, and they keep their mind upon God in that way. And then there are the others that through bhakti, through devotion, they have a love for God. But what all of them learn to do is to attune themselves to the higher vibrations. And they unconsciously, perhaps, raise the life force up the spine. But how much better it is, even if it's not playing to our particular strength, if we learn how to consciously guide the life force up the spine and into the higher regions of the brain. You can see why that's the most direct way. That is the way that we can get to the goal the quickest, even blending it in with the other paths. When the ascetic who is busy with disciplining the body, putting it through rigorous austerities, may attain a degree of control over the physical instrumentality, but merely practicing postures, enduring cold and heat, and not giving in to sorrow or pleasure, without simultaneously concentrating on cosmic consciousness, is only a roundabout pathway to gaining the mental control necessary for God communion. The yogi attains communion with the Lord directly by withdrawing his consciousness from the senses and nervous system, the spine and the brain, and uniting it with his God-knowing soul. Many devotees are so engrossed in following the precepts of external asceticism and renunciation that they forget that ecstasy with the infinite is the purpose of such self-discipline. When scriptural philosopher dissects words and thoughts with the scalpel of his reason, he may grow so fond of theoretical knowledge and of mentally separating wisdom into various segments that he may dry up through the lack of experience of truth in divine ecstasy. If a person spent his life in analyzing the properties of water and in examining water from different sources all over the world, he would not thereby quench his thirst. A thirsty man, without fussing over the atomic constituencies, selects some good water, drinking it, and becomes satisfied. An exoteric yana yogi, who a follower of the path of discriminative reason, may read and analyze all the scriptures and still not slack his soul thirst. A theoretical knowledge of scriptures often produces conviction that one knows the truth when he actually does not know it. Only by communion with God, the library of all knowledge, may one know all the truths in their exactitude, without wasting time in theoretical understanding and misunderstanding of the scriptures. That is why a wide gulf may exist between the scripture readers and men of realization who are themselves embodiments of scriptural truths. One time Mother said, what at the time seemed a little bit amazing considering her emphasis on the Christian scriptures, and she said, "I've never read the Bible from cover to cover. Never." What would happen is that in her experiences, God would take her to different scriptural references and then show her, explain to her, what you are just going through now is what this scripture is referring to. And so she found that the scriptures, the source of all knowledge, was right within her, and then was guiding her through the scriptures and showing her how these truths were embedded within the words, hiding behind the words. A philosopher can be like the one who takes the nut, and he takes the outside shell and he examines the outside shell, but he never eats the internal meat of the nut. He's just too fascinated with the shell of the nut. But the yogi goes directly to the nut and eats and is satisfied thereby. Master continuing, the Pharisees were willing to crucify Christ because they surmised fearfully that he was a threat to their authority, having actually perceived the truths that they knew only in theory. That's a fascinating thing, and one thing to think of is relating that to an internal truth within ourselves. There's a part of us who almost universally throughout mankind is afraid of realization. And you have to ask yourself, why would I be afraid of realization, ultimate truth, ultimate love, ultimate freedom? Why in the world would I resist that? And the reason is that it upsets, potentially, the order that you have so carefully created in your life. And it really takes a very healthy ego in order to surrender yourself. The symbology of taking the most perfect sheep at the sacrifice. You have to be that perfect sheep. You have to have a certain amount of self-mastery. You have to have a certain amount of self-confidence. And dare I say, you have to have a pretty healthy ego in order to do this. If you don't, you don't have a stable enough position in which to approach God. And if you have any serious defects in the ego department, then you're probably not going to get there, because you always find yourself on shifting sand. And so we have to cultivate to some degree, creating a healthy ego, creating a healthy self-image, to be able to go out into the world and be able to create what it is that we feel directed to create in this world. To have that amount of self-confidence. To have that amount of backbone within us. Because that means the life force is flowing freely within the spine. It's not blocked. And so we have to learn how to become masters in this world as well as spiritual masters. And therefore, many of us are doing both at the same time. We're learning to go out into this world, to accomplish in this world, and then we're learning to surrender the results of that accomplishment, and it's all at the same time. Lastly, the yogi is also deemed greater than the man of action, the missionary, the social worker, the man of goodwill who practices the golden rule towards others, the teacher who tries to instruct others in the technique of God communion, all no doubt perform good actions. But unless they also devote themselves to inner science, by which they can know God through their inner experience, they will remain without divine realization. That is why the yogi meditates and concentrates on the attainment of ecstasy until he achieves that state of inner attunement with God. He performs his duties, but not divert himself with the many outward activities at the cost of forgetting the Lord. The yogi teaches and serves others in the highest way by his inspiring life. Example ever speaks louder than words. Example ever speaks louder than words. Reform thyself, and thou wilt reform thousands. Forgetting God is the greatest sin. Communion with God is the highest virtue. And so through these words and through these teachings, we learn how to purify our goal. We are constantly setting goals, whether we think of it in that way or not. If we have some hunger and we decide to set out to get something to eat, our goal is to assuage the hunger through the food that we're going to take. We're constantly in search of goals in order to satisfy ourselves. But to learn to satisfy our soul hunger is the greatest thing that we can do. To learn to get interested in God, even to love God, to fall in love with God, and to want God more than anything else in this world. There are so many things to take us in so many directions. Many of them could be good directions. Many of them could be entertaining. Many of them could even be uplifting. But unless they are focused on the absolute and purest goal, we will not attain that goal. So do an examination with yourself. See, what is it that you set your goals on from day to day? And do you include in that, first and foremost, the divine goal, the goal of total and complete realization? Or do you get sidetracked with this and that and the other thing? You see, you work everything. Your work gets turned into karma yoga. You serve God through your work. Your family gets turned into karma yoga and bhakti yoga. You serve with loving attention to your family. When you look into the scriptures and you look to get informed on what is the highest and best way to guide your life, you're using your intellect to learn how to discern what is good from what takes you further away from your true goal. And most of all, we're given this tremendous gift of meditation, of hongsa, of kriya yoga, of chanting God's name, all designed to take us further and further within, until we get into that complete inner stillness, that joy, that love, that light that surpasses every description and takes us into the eternal splendor from which we have come and to which we return. And with Papa's wonderful quote here, the end of sadhana is to realize our oneness with the eternal and immutable Atman, that is the pure soul, and perform all actions in the field of manifestation. So when we have come to that place where we realize our oneness with the eternal and immutable Atman, not just in a moment of meditation, not just occasionally, but that it becomes a constant feature, and there is nothing but that for us. You see, when we come together like this, there is a quickening that happens. The soul is uplifted. There is a spiritual ambiance that goes out that helps to uplift the soul. and you benefit greatly. But also every day when you enter into your meditation spot and you come onto your meditation blanket, and you really, it's like I have this MP3 player, and it has a docking station. If I put it in the docking station, it does two things. It charges it up, and plus it reloads it with new instructions and new material as it comes into it. And you can think of your meditation chair, your meditation blanket, as your docking station. You plug in to the infinite current there, and it recharges you. If you're connected, you see, you have to be connected. It doesn't work if you don't get the little plug into the pin there. So you got to get the medulla plugged in, right? And you feel that life energy come in, and it will recharge you. And it will download new information. It will come embedded with it with wisdom, insight, understanding. For many years, just a little side note, I've been thinking about what is the inner meaning with Yudhishthira, who is the eldest of the Pandavas, and why does he go gambling and lose all the kingdom? And God gave me the answer the other day, and I thought it was just wonderful. And because each one of the chakras on the way up, the six chakras, they all have a dual aspect to them. There's a positive and a negative. And Yudhishthira represents discrimination, wisdom. And he's at the fifth chakra, the throat chakra there. And what God showed me was that on that negative charge of that discrimination is pride enters in there, and a thought of being infallible. And because of that, he goes gambling. He becomes reckless. He's willing to gamble things away. He doesn't properly guard the truths that he's given. And he thinks of himself as infallible now. And because of that, he loses everything. Everything. And it is only because of grace that he retains anything at all, but still he has to go into 13 years of the wilderness. And so this is a terrible thing that he has to go through. But still he has the opportunity to be able to come back. Because no matter how far we fall, God always paves a road. It may be a rocky road, it may be a difficult road, it may have thorns in the road, but there is a road by which we may get back. And so he is given that opportunity in order to get back. So we cannot become arrogant, you see. We cannot become fast and loose with these spiritual truths. We have to keep our shoulder to the wheel. But we should do it, as Papa says, happily, joyfully, with a sense of mirth, a sense of a little twinkle in the eye. And we can say, aha, God, I've seen you now. You were trying to tempt me away from yourself, but I get the game. And now I'm back on track. Now I'm back on track. So let us learn to live with this and be in this joy. To be in this joy and to joyfully be upon this path. If you please pray with me, O Heavenly Father. Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet and surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am he.
Blessed Spirit, I am he.
Oh. peace, bless. Amen. May Babaji, Lahamahasha, Swami Sri Yukteswarji, Master, Mother, ever bless you and keep you, guiding you into your eternal home, where you will forever and ever remain in that joyful bliss.